You are listening to a Sun Life podcast. We pray that you will be blessed with the teaching of God's word. For more sermons, visit sunlife.org.au. Well, have you ever been in a hostile situation? Like in a hostile workplace or maybe a friendship group, you know, it's a bit hostile? Yeah, maybe. I envision that a lot of people have. Personally, this week I found myself at work in a hostile situation. I'm not talking about the church office. There's no saucy goodness there. That's just boring, mundane. No, that's great. I'm talking about my other workplace. I find myself in this really hostile environment. In a nutshell, removing the names, of course, this is what's going on. Work has a number of work utes, right? And one guy, John, believes that the work ute is his ute, his personal ute. So he, you know, has the keys. He makes sure that no one touches the keys. Ben, or Bill, whoever. Just go Ben. Ben, on the other hand, right, he is very upset because he needs to get work done and he needs transport for a particular task. Anyway, so there's this, I'm not aware of this, but there's this going on behind the scenes where he's stealing these keys and these keys are getting, you know, and like playing hide and seek on everyone's stuff. I come and I'm like oblivious. So I'm driving with Ben, right? He's got the beef with John. And we're driving along and I see John driving past in the ute. I said, "Hey, there's John, he's really hauling." Just a naive comment. Well, Ben responds to me and he's like, "That's Mr. He thinks he owns the ute." I'm thinking like, "Mr. He thinks he owns the ute? I mean, what's that all about?" We go into it. He explains. And I was thinking about this conversation that I had with him after the fact. And I was like, isn't it interesting that when we have a problem with someone, we view them through the lens of the issue. Like we view them through the lens that of their wrong. And as I was thinking about it, I was like, I had prepared other things to say to intro, but I was like, this actually segues beautifully into the book of Romans and where we are right now. Because where we find ourselves is just over the hump of the negative stuff. So God was talking about in the first 2.5 chapters of Romans how we're messed up, we're sinful. We've got, Paul was talking about, you know, how all has fallen short and no one's to blame. And there's this condemnation and this judgment and this, you know, all hope is lost, right? And in a sense, God is seeing humanity through the lens of their sin and their wrong. And then Paul, toward the end of chapter 3, like, presents this astounding statement. He shares this amazing thing. And this is what he says. It's just incredible. "There is righteousness from God through faith for all who believe in Jesus." How incredible is that, right? There's this, you know, condemnation, judgment, frustration, and then, bang, straight in to Romans, end of Romans 3, there's this proclamation, the good news, the gospel. Paul brings out this, when we thought all hope was lost, when we thought everything was, you know, up the creek, God provides a way for us. And no longer does he view us through the lens of sin and through the lens of what we've done wrong, but he views us through the lens of Jesus. And so instead of saying, "Hey, there's Mr. owns, he thinks he owns the ute," God sees us and he says, "There's Mr. Perfect. There's Mr. Righteous." That's the grace of God. And that's where we find ourselves this morning, that God has given this unmerited gift and it's for us. And so this morning, Paul goes on to chapter 4, which is where we're at now, chapter 4, and he basically expands on that big statement. There is righteousness. There is a righteousness of God for all who believe. So that is what we're going to be unpacking this morning. The whole of chapter 4. Just give me the whole chapter. That's fine. I'll do it. In this chapter, he's basically pulling out one of these big Old Testament greats, Abraham, And he also references David as well. Big heavyweights of the Old Testament. These guys that were admired and looked up to. And he's using Abraham as a case study or as someone that we can look at to get some understanding of what this righteousness is about. So this morning, we're just going to have a look at three observations. We're going to have a look at these three observations surrounded by the gift of righteousness. And here they are. The first one is the expense of the gift. So basically, how much does this thing cost? Right? How much does righteousness cost? The extension of the gift. So who can receive righteousness? Who can get it? And then the experience of the gift, which is what is it like? What is the experience like? What does it mean to be righteous? That's where we're going. So let's take a look at the first point, the expense of the gift. How much does it cost? And let's read from chapter 4. I'm a bit old school, so I'll take the Bible. Here we go. So from verse 1, "What then shall we say was gained by Abraham, our forefather, according to the flesh? For if Abraham was justified by works, he has something to boast about, but not before God. For what does Scripture say? Abraham believed God, and it was counted to him as righteousness. Now to the one who works, his wages are not counted as a gift, but as his due. And to the one who does not work, but believes in him who justifies the ungodly, his faith is counted to him as righteousness. Just as David also speaks of the blessing of the one whom God counts righteousness apart from works. Blessed are those whose lawless deeds are forgiven and whose sins are covered. Blessed is the man against whom the Lord will not count his sin." How cool is that? So what's Paul saying in this first chunk? He's saying that God justifies, which justification is the act of making right. So he's saying that God justifies, makes us right with God for free. It's a gift from God, and therefore we cannot demand it or boast about it. All right, let's have a look at that. In this passage, I see that there's two, I guess, key things that are going on. And there's two comparisons. There's one comparison between the gift and the wage. He's drawing these two distinctions. And there's a comparison between an attitude of humility versus pride. So let's have a look at those together. So the first thing is the gift and the wage. In verse 4 and 5, he talks about how there's this idea of someone who works for a wage as opposed to someone who receives a gift. And as I was thinking about this, what is the difference between a wage and a gift? Like, I'm sure that there's many different differences when it comes to wage and gift, but I think one of the key differences between a wage and a gift is who's in control. You know what I'm saying? So who's in control? So who's in control when you give a gift? The giver, right? The giver selects the gift. The giver selects the wrapping paper. The giver wraps it. The giver chooses what time to give it. On the other hand, who's in control when it comes to the wage? Well, obviously the boss has the money, but generally it's the receiver who's actually, he's worked for it, and now he can say, give me, you know, what I've earned. You know, I've put in the hard work, now give me what's due. So you've got these two pictures. So the giver's in control for a gift, and the worker is in control to receive what's debited to him, what he deserves. So those are the two tensions that Paul is pulling on right now. And what he's saying is, God gives the gift. So it's a bit odd if a worker goes up to his boss, and the boss says, hey, I've got a great gift for you, your wage. And it's like, gee, thanks, how generous of you. Is there a little bonus or anything? No, it's just what you earned. Oh, right. Paul's saying that Abraham can't do this, right? He can't walk up to God and say, hey, give me what I'm due, because Abraham hasn't worked for it. God has given it. That's pretty clear, right? That's pretty, that explains itself. So God is in control of this gift, when he gives it, who he gives it to, why he gives it, and we are the recipients, we are the receivers of that. The second comparison that Paul makes here is between this attitude of pride and humility. So in the second verse it says, "For if Abraham was justified by works," so if he earned it, if he worked for it, then he had something to boast about. Right? He can say to his work colleagues, he say to his, you know, fellow family, "Hey, look at me. I've put in this hard work, and now I get what I'm due." But it doesn't say that. He says, not before God. He can't boast before God. So then what is going on? And I guess if the attitude of pride is boasting, then the attitude of faith is humility. So there's these two comparisons between faith and between boasting and works. And so on the one hand, pride will say, "How good am I?" Right? Pride says that. The other hand, humility says, "How grateful am I?" So one's how great am I, one is how grateful am I. And that sort of contrast between the two. So a gift is best received, and it can't be received in the nature of pride. How good am I? But it's received on the other hand, how grateful am I? And it points to the giver, right? It points to the giver. John Calvin explains faith as like this. He says, he likens faith to that of open hands. So faith isn't a work, but it's a posture of receiving. And I guess that points, like you've got this picture of humility as open hands, like as we receive faith. It's not as though we're earning faith or we're trying to build our faith, but faith is actually just opening our hands and receiving what God would have for us, receiving what God would give to us. Alternatively, I've got this picture of this toddler or 2.5, almost 3-year-old at the dinner table where he's closed-fisted, he's thumping the high chair, or he's, you know, he's unhappy and he's demanding, you know, "Give me food, you know, I want food." I think some of us have been in that situation where you just think, man, is he going to humbly receive this, or is he just going to, like, he's going to run me over for this food? But I guess those are the two pictures that we have that are contrasted between this open-handedness and this closed-fistedness of, "I'm going to work and I'm going to earn it." So those are the two things. And what Paul is saying, all of this, he sums off with this big quote from David, another, this big Old Testament great, and he talks in verses 6 and 7 about how gracious God is when he forgives the unrighteous, when he doesn't account sin to them. He doesn't put sin on them. And that is all of that to say, it's free. God gives us this free gift. The expense of the gift, free. But obviously, free gifts don't come easy always for us, right? Maybe because we like to be in control. Maybe because we have this innate pride, so we don't want to receive things from people, but we, you know, we want to earn it. We don't want to have pity from others, but, you know, we'll look like we've got it all together. So we don't want to receive anything. For me, I've got Dutch descent, Dutch Australian sort of descent. That's actually some friends from Melbourne. They're also Dutch, quite tall, blonde. You know, that's the. I'm not that Dutch, but. I'm close. Anyways, Dutch Australian people, they can be quite cynical and quite independent, right? And so when there's something free on the table, there's a lot of questions about it, right? You can imagine, you know, this person's giving me this free gift. What's this all about, right? Why are they giving it? What do they want from me? What's going on? You know, like, do I touch it? Do I not? So then you start thinking, if I do take this, then maybe, you know, they'll want something from me. So I don't really want to have to pay them back, so maybe I won't take the gift, right? And we don't say that. We say things like, no, how about I pay for the bill? Or how about, no, just keep it for yourself, you enjoy it, so that we don't fall into this debt. And sometimes we can take that thinking into our relationship with God. We can take that understanding of this free gift and we can think, oh, God's going to now have leverage over me. You know, he gives me this free gift, but there's strings attached, right? And so sometimes we behave like God is this money lender where he, you know, we can't afford righteousness, so he lends us some money and then we receive the money, but then we have to pay it back with good works. You know, like the gift wasn't free, it was just a loan. No, that's not what it says here. That's not what Paul's saying. He's saying that the gift of righteousness is a gift to keep, to enjoy. That's not so that you get entrapped and enslaved, but it is something that God gives us to be thankful, to be humble, to be enjoyed. So then if the gift of righteousness is really free, what should that do inside of us? What should that stir inside of us? Well, I believe it would do at least two things. The first thing, we should be the most thankful people in the world, right? Like, how good is God? How great is God that he would be so generous, so kind, so willing to give us this gift? We would be grateful. You know, how great is he? How grateful are we? So this should change how we, you know, how we behave, how we talk. We wouldn't be looking at life through a negative lens, but a positive lens. Like, this is an incredible life that we've been given. This is a great day that we have. I mean, I'm not talking about being just chipper and like overly expressive and exaggerated, but I'm just saying deep in us, we should have this thankfulness that should just be rising up, ready to surface at any moment. To contrast, that would be a negative. Pulling out the negatives of things, complaining about things. When we've received this gift, this should stir in us a great thankfulness. And secondly, it should make us increasingly more humble. When we receive this, we should grow in humility. Like Abraham couldn't boast about the gift of righteousness, we also can't boast. I mean, this is a gift. Sure, some of us have done some great things, and I'm sure that we'll be doing many more great things. But when it comes to righteousness, we are so much more in debt to God than that we've accumulated all these great works that he should pay us. And so we should grow in that humility. And when I mean grow in humility, I'm meaning grow in the open-handedness that John Calvin was talking about. Growing in this, I'm looking to you, God. I need you for this. Growing in that trust, growing in that faith. So the expense of righteousness, the expense of the gift is free. First point. Second point, the extension of the gift. So who is it extended to? Have a look with me at starting at verse 9, and this is what Paul says. Is this blessing then only for the circumcised, or also for the uncircumcised? For we say that faith was accounted to Abraham as righteousness. How then was it accounted to him? Was it before or after he had been circumcised? It was not after, but before he was circumcised. He received the sign of circumcision as a seal of righteousness that he had by faith while he was still uncircumcised. The purpose was to make him the father of all who believe without being circumcised, so that righteousness would be counted to them as well, and to make him the father of the circumcised who are not merely circumcised, but also who walk in the footsteps of faith that our father Abraham had before he was circumcised. For the promise to Abraham and his offspring that he would be the heir of the world did not come through the law, but through the righteousness of faith. For if it is the adherents of the law who are to be the heirs, faith is null and the promise is void. For the law brings wrath, but there is no law. Where there is no law, there is no transgression. But this is why it depends on faith, in order that the promise may rest on grace and be guaranteed to all his offspring, not only to the adherent of the law, but also to the one who shares the faith of Abraham, who is the father of us all. Great. So there's a lot of alls in there. But what is Paul saying? Paul is saying this, that the gift of righteousness is extended to all, right? That's just something that we believe. In other words, God is not looking for this outward good work or this outward adherence to the law, or, you know, maybe it's a ritual, maybe it's circumcision. I'm very thankful that it's not circumcision. But God isn't looking for this before He extends righteousness to all of us. Because if it was only for the morally good in society, if it was only for those who were circumcised, then it would narrow down the scope of who God could give this gift. But Paul is saying, no, it's not so. So where do I get this from? Where does this come from? Verse 9, is this blessing, Paul's talking about the righteousness, then only for the circumcised or the uncircumcised? In other words, is it for the Jews or is it for everyone? The response is, faith was counted to Abraham as righteousness, not circumcision. So faith being these open hands that Abraham would receive. So then Paul goes on to explain in verse 10 that the timing of when Abraham was made right was not after he was circumcised, but before he was circumcised. So he's building this really strong case that it's not the circumcision, right? That's not what makes people right. It's not the good rituals. It's not coming to church. It's not all these things that make us right with God, like we are earning it, but it is already something that was promised. It was already something that was given. Can you imagine what they would be thinking? I know what I'm thinking. If we don't have to get circumcised for righteousness, why would we do it? I mean, it hurts and all these other complications involved. I mean, why then go through the ritual of circumcision if it's not something that we do to achieve God's favor, achieve God's love? Well, if we dig back into the Old Testament, we dig back into when circumcision came and why it came and what this passage talks about, it's a sign, it's a symbol, it's a picture, it's a reminder to the people of what God has done. So it isn't the act of making right, the justification, so to speak, but it is the reminder. It's looking back in the revision mirror and going, hey, that is what God's done. We have this thing to celebrate. We have this thing to enjoy. Because I don't know about you, but I'm forgetful. I know God's people were forgetful, and I'm sure we can all forget things at times, and having visual reminders are a great way to jog the memory of what God has done, what He's done that is not seen. So circumcision is one of those reminders. Circumcision is one of those things in the Old Testament, or in the Bible, that God uses as a symbol. God uses heaps of other things in the Bible as symbols for God's people, right? We could name a whole heap of different things. Even rocks He uses, you know, or special shrines and things like that. Turns out cars also have a lot of symbols on them, yeah? You know, like cars, like the ones we drive and stuff. Yeah, so if you're driving the new cars more so, you're driving without a seatbelt on, the little sign in the dash pops up and flashes red, sometimes there's a noise. Fuel gauge, running low on fuel, fill up. You know, these serve as reminders of what we should do. A couple years back, I was working at a plant nursery and I spent a lot of time doing deliveries and different things, and we had this work van. Anyway, so the boss says to me, hey, can you pick up a few things from a particular place and bring them back? I'm like, sure. So I grab the keys, look in the car park, there's the work van, jump in there, bit of an old van, bit, you know, not the flashiest thing, fires up, no worries. A few lights light up on the dash, which is pretty normal because it's an old car, you know, you just let it run for a while and the lights go away. So I was like, all right, great. Let's go. Put it in reverse, take off. And I'm driving for about 5 minutes now, and the lights are still there. And I'm starting to think, something's not right. The temperature gauge, you know, off the spectrum, right? It's just the needle's like, thinking, this is not good. There's various other lights. I'm not even sure what they're about, but I know that they're not good. The heat, like, because it's a van, the engine sits underneath where you're sitting. It's getting hot in the van. And I'm starting to stress a bit, so I pull over into the servo and I hear this sizzling noise. This is not good. Call up the boss. I said, the foreman. I said, the van's not running very well. And he's like, let me just check. And then he comes back. He's like, don't drive the van anymore. I'm like, oh, what happened? He's like, the mechanic's halfway through a service. He's taken the fan belts off. There's no oil in it, right? And this thing's overheating because it's just... And what did... I mean, we sorted out. I got towed back and, you know, everything was fine. But I ignored the reminders, right, in the dash. And I guess, question for you guys. Would I solve the problem by just covering up the lights or by just sort of making the lights go away? Obviously, you could try that, but it's not going to end well. That doesn't solve the problem. And I feel like sometimes we see humanity's problem as just a lack of complying to a set of rules. But actually, the first part of Romans and the Bible constantly talks about humanity's problem is not the rituals as such, it's not the outward, but it's actually what's going on deep inside of us. It's a broken heart. We've got issues deep within us. And God, when He gives us this gift, He heals that, He fixes that. And then what it follows is this healthy lifestyle, not the other way around. And so obviously as Christians, we don't practice the act of circumcision, but we have other symbols, right? And we actually have another symbol coming up very soon, baptism, right? And that's where we say, this is a way that we show everyone in the community of what God's doing inside someone internally. It's not the other way around, like, oh, we think that God might want to save you. Here, let's dunk you and then you'll be right and then off you go. But it is a reflection of what's going on internally. So this is where I make a little transition to a small plug. If you're sitting here this morning not believing, if you are on the edge, or if you see that coming to faith or being called a Christian is a set of hoops that you have to do things to earn or to, you know, make God happy, and then, you know, you get baptized, then I'm here to say that's not true. And if you are in a place where you are saying, hey, I'm willing to open up my hands and say, I'm not going to earn my position with God, but I'm here to receive that from Him, then we would love for you to explore that with us. If you were interested in baptism, or if you were in that place, speak to one of the Connect Group leaders, speak to one of the leaders. If you don't know one of the leaders, find a Sun Lifer. I'm sure they'll point you in the right direction. But today is the last day to sign up, so be quick. Right, don't miss out on this opportunity. And for those of us who have been a Christian for a long time, right, who, you know, have heard a lot of this before, what is there for us? Well, this passage, this section of the passage, should lead us to opening our eyes to the possibilities that God could save anyone, even the most rough, the most terrible person in the world. God is strong enough and incapable to save them as well. So who is that for you in your context? Who is that rough person that you could be praying for, that you could be extending the gift of God to? Let's believe in the promise of God for that person, that God would save, that God would do His work there. How good. So we've just seen that the expense of righteousness is free. We've just seen that the extension of righteousness is for all. Last thing, and we're going to conclude on this one, the experience of righteousness. So what is the experience of righteousness like? Let's go to the passage. Let's have a read. As it is written, from verse 17, as it is written, I have made you the father of many nations, in the presence of God, in whom he believed, who gives life to the dead and calls into existence the things that do not exist. In hope he believed against hope, that he should become the father of many nations. As he has been told, so shall your offspring be. He did not weaken in the faith when he considered his own body, which was as good as dead, since he was about 100 years old, or when he considered the barrenness of Sarah's womb. No unbelief made him waver concerning the promise of God, but he grew strong in his faith as he gave glory to God, fully convinced that God was able to do what he had promised. That is why faith was counted to him as righteousness. But the words, it was counted to him, were not written for his sake alone, but for ours also. It will not be counted to us. It will be counted to us who believe in him who raised from the dead Jesus our Lord, who was delivered up for our trespasses and raised for our justification. So what is this passage all about? What is Paul trying to say here in our concluding point? He says this: righteousness is a certainty. It's a solid promise. It's an assurance that we have. In other words, when God says, or when God promises something, he won't withdraw it. In other words, God's promise is not squishy, like, or flexible. You know, I'll take it this time, I'll say it this time, and then won't say it that time. But it's certain, it's solid, we can rely on it, we can depend on it, we can have confidence and assurance. So what does Paul point to for this to be true? Well, he looks at Abraham and the promises God gave to Abraham. Genesis 15 has a whole heap of promises. If you want to go there, you can have a look at that in your own time. But one of the promises that Paul particularly harbors on is this promise of a great nation, promise of a great family to Abraham. And so Paul uses this as an example of how Abraham experienced righteousness, how he experienced this true, genuine faith. So I've got a question. When Abraham was promised that he would be a great nation, was he a great nation? No. Did he, what does the passage say? Was he old? Yeah. He's already got one obstacle. He was old. He considered Sarah's barrenness. So that's another obstacle, right? Difficult obstacle. Other obstacle is, obviously, there's no children currently, so that's an obstacle. All right. And then the passage talks about how, you know, he didn't waver in that, though, right? He didn't waver in that. So then you start thinking, well, a quick look at, you know, Abraham's life and his story, and you think, oh, it does seem like he did waver a little bit. Like, when God said that he would make you a great nation, and then Abraham laughed about it, sort of laughed in God's face, like, as if that's going to happen, look at all the obstacles. Or, you know, he doubted Sarah could have his child, so then he went off and did other things with a servant. Or perhaps when he was just telling lies about how Sarah, his wife, was not his wife, but his sister, so that, you know, things wouldn't go bad for him. Obviously, there's times where we see Abraham wavered. So what is the passage talking about? I believe the passage, there's actually a lot of interpretations around this. A lot of people say a lot of things, but where I want to go with this and where I feel like this means is that overall, there was this up and down of Abraham. And overall, we have these ups and downs of faith. But the big picture, Abraham was faithful. Abraham did believe God. And ultimately, when he was faced with this decision to sacrifice his son Isaac, or to, withhold him from God, he was willing to give Isaac up. And that's where God could see, that's where we can see that Abraham had this solid faith. But obviously sometimes life experiences and circumstances can sort of mess with us, can sort of see God in a different light, like that his promises are not true. Last youth ministry, so this was a couple years ago, I had this girl in the youth ministry that she was a troubled kid. Like, she was causing a lot of trouble, like, all the time. And she was in anger management classes, she was seeing counselling, she was getting passed around, like, different foster homes. The parents can't deal with her and that kind of thing. And she started to come to the youth ministry, which I was excited about. You know, it's great. You know, we want to love everyone, and that's good. But then we're in this small group setting, and she's causing all this chaos, and all these things are happening, and she's drawing on people and saying mean things to people. And I'm just thinking, how do I get her to stop? How do I get her to just for a second, like, give me some relief so I can actually teach what's going on, and then we can move on. So I said to her, like, you know, every good parent does, if you behave right now, I will give you a reward. I think it was like a chocolate bar or something. It was just something nice, right? Obviously, food is the best bribe. So I use the food tactic. I'm thinking, great, no problems. And she turns around, she says to me, your words mean nothing. You know, people's words mean nothing. So I don't even know if I'm going to get it. I'm thinking, oh, how do I communicate that I'm serious, like I really will come through with this? So I said, I promise you that I will give you this reward if you... And she looks at me and said, my parents have promised me so many things and they've never come through with any of it. To which I was thinking, I thought I had like paper, scissors, dynamite. I thought I was going to... There's a slam dunk, right? I thought I had her on the ropes and, you know, no way. She's like, I'm not believing you for a second. And sometimes we can project, you know, these damaging relationships or these damaging promises that people have made to us on God, as if God is not a loving Father, as if God is not integral to His Word. But God is integral to His Word. I mean, Abraham, if you look at Abraham, Abraham is a classic example of how God came through with His promises, is it not? Like, God promised him all these things, a nation, a land, a great name. Did Abraham have that, you know, at the promise? No. Did he get that? Yes. Israel is a great nation. He got the promised land. He got a great name. God came through with his promises to Abraham. And I'm here to say that God comes through with his promises to us. He does. And I want to urge us this morning, I want to compel us this morning that God will do what he says he will do. God will come through with his promises toward us. Now the question is, what are his promises to us that I can be sure of? Because there's a lot of people saying that God promises all kinds of things, Ferraris and all different things. But what are the concrete promises of God that we can trust in, that we know that he's not going to retract? And I'd say they, to use Abraham as an example, we can also rely on the promises of God for a great family, for a great name, and for a great land. How does that work? We're promised a great family. When we become believers, when we are born into the family of God, we are adopted into this great family. God gives us this great family. We're promised a great name. We go from Mr. Sinful to Mr. Saint. How good is that? A new identity. We're not an enemy of God, but we are a friend, what we sung about. And the promise of a great land. We look forward to a new heaven, a new earth. How good is that? So they're just three of the promises that God gives us. My question to us this morning is, do we live in that? Yeah, come on up. Do we live in that? Do we live in the promises of God? Do we remind ourselves of the promises of God? Abraham heard the promises of God from God. Where do we hear from the promises of God? From His Word. I encourage you, if you are discouraged, if you are feeling flat, come to the promises of God found in His Word. Enjoy that. Live in that. And these promises are based on God's gift of righteousness. So if the expense of righteousness is a free gift, if it's freely given to us, then we should in turn give freely. If the extension of righteousness is for all, it's not dependent on good works, then we should give to those just because, no other reason. We should extend our love to people just for that reason. None. And if the experience of righteousness is solid, if we have an assurance of a greater thing to come, an anticipation of something great to come, we don't have to hold on dearly to the things that we have now that we can give away to someone. Let's just take a moment now. Let's pray and seek God for what He might lead us in this week.